Hearing is 003354 CR, State v. Sherry S. Tucker. Assistant State Public Defender Paul G. Lazat. That's your appropriate pronunciation. Has 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Lazat.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Lazat, and I represent Sherry Tucker. Ms. Tucker should receive a new trial. For when her jury was selected, the attorneys were under an order not to refer to any juror by name. Rather, they were instructed to refer to the jurors by number. Defense counsel objected. He explained that he feared that procedure would suggest to the jury that they had reason to fear for their physical safety because of Ms. Tucker. They did not. The particular facts of this case...
Why would they fear for their physical safety because of this procedure, counsel?
Being referred to by number could suggest to the jurors that their names should not be known by this defendant because this defendant was a dangerous person or was associated with people who were dangerous.
So you're concerned more about the impression than what reality happened? In other words, as I understand the process there, everything was known to all counsel, including the defendant, the names, addresses, occupation, everything that would be known about any juror or any questions asked. The exception was, instead of saying juror John Jones, it was juror 214, whatever numbers they used. That was the only difference.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because in the certification, the Court of Appeals asked, and, you know, we have the seminal case of Britt, we have Williams' case, we have... some of the other cases, but this, and there's a, in Britt, there is a standard, but this was an exception, so they asked the question whether this, in fact, was an anonymous jury when all of those facts, with the exception, were known to the defendant herself, and that's why I'm asking to...
Correct. I think Britt and Murillo were correct in defining an anonymous jury to include a situation where counsel cannot refer to the jurors by name. I see that there's two distinct concerns here for the defendant as well as the state. In jury selection, both attorneys would like to have access to identifying information about the potential jurors so they can pick a fair and impartial jury. That's one concern. That's not present in this case. The second concern is the impression created upon the jurors when they are left with that impression that the defendant is not to know their name. When they're sitting in the open courtroom during the selection, and in fact, in this case, at one point, defense counsel inadvertently started to refer to one of the potential jurors by his surname. The court interrupted him and instructed him to please follow the practice. There was no further explanation given to the jurors about why that was the case. So in other words, although the jurors heard the judge tell trial counsel, "It's my practice," they did not receive any prophylactic cautionary instruction that the fact that they were to be referred to by number in court rather than name, they were to draw no conclusions from that.
Mr. Lazat, does the record reflect at all whether any of the prospective jurors had served previously on a jury?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. There were actually, of the potential jurors, there were four who had previously served on criminal juries, three of whom made it onto this jury.
The reason I'm asking that is it's my understanding that Judge Miller had this as a normal practice. In other words, that in every drug case, at least, she would have the the attorneys use numbers when referring to the jurors. So if that's true, then at least some of these jurors had experience previously with the same type of procedure, I'm assuming. If they had served on drug cases, I guess I don't know that.
Right. The jurors, as I understand the record, none of them indicated that they had served on criminal juries in her court. One juror, if my memory serves me correctly, had served on a federal jury in Milwaukee and had served on a disorderly conduct jury in Racine. Another juror had served on a domestic violence case in Racine. And a third juror who made it onto the jury had served on an armed robbery case.
Not on drugs.
Okay. So obviously none of them have had experience with her rule.
Correct.
Her courtroom. So the basis for your objection, counsel, is that the effect that it had on the jurors.
Correct.
Do you have any other bases for your objection?
No. The concern here is that the jurors, just perceiving that they have to be referred to by number, could lead them to speculate that the person they're trying presents a danger to them.
Is there any case or article that would, or statistics that you have for the court that would indicate that this is something that would cause the juror to have the impression that their safety or security may be questioned?
I don't have access to any empirical studies, Your Honor, where jurors were surveyed about what effect that had on them. What I do have, though, is 8 federal courts of appeals who have taken it as a given that this practice does diminish, does erode, does compromise to some extent the presumption of innocence.
This singular practice.
Pardon?
This singular practice.
Correct. And to be clear, in the federal cases, those were what I would call fully anonymous juries.
Yes.
In the cases that I read where counsel was precluded from having the identifying information.
And that's why I asked the initial question, counsel, that this was I won't say hybrid, but it was, looking at those cases, this didn't seem to me, and certainly it's arguable, that it fit in, and I wasn't sure just what...
Right, it doesn't fit in precisely. I think in this particular instance, counsel's ability to ask appropriate questions during jury selection to obtain a fair and impartial jury, that was not impinged. What was impinged is the jury's impression. So perhaps it's reasonable to make a distinction between a jury that is anonymously selected and one that anonymously serves, and yet a third jury that is anonymous in both ways.
Counsel, what did the jurors know about what the defendant knew? Did they know that the defendant knew their names?
I don't believe the jury did.
The record doesn't reflect that.
No.
But the record does reflect that at one point the defendant's lawyer did try to call one of the jurors by their name.
Right. There was two instances.
Go ahead.
As I understand the record, the court informed the attorneys before the jury came in, this is my practice, we're going to refer to the jurors by number in open court. And there was two instances where the issue was kind of stumbled over. At one point, a potential juror was excused for cause, and the judge started to call up another juror. And if I recall correctly, she said, Mike stopped, juror 274. And then the other instance was where defense counsel was questioning one of the potential jurors about relatives who were law enforcement officers, and inadvertently referred to as Mr. by his last name.
Well, the jurors knew, of course, that their names were known to somebody because they had to fill out the juror questionnaire form, etc. Who would they be led to believe knew their names.
I would assume the clerk of court's office and those responsible for selecting jurors. Because if I'm recalling the record correctly, every time during the jury selection process they were referred to, it was by number, not by name.
The voir dire was recorded, right?
Pardon?
The voir dire was
correct.
Recorded. Okay. Sometimes counsel says, what he or she knows about the juries, like I'm familiar with your occupations or some kind of introductory comments, anything like that here?
I don't recall either counsel making comments to the jurors that, you know, I have a base of information about you right now.
Counsel, as I looked at a few of the federal cases, and our Britt case, not by any means all of the ones that are cited, the premise is pretty well accepted that an anonymous jury raises the specter that the defendant is a dangerous person from whom the jurors must be protected, thereby implicating the defendant's constitutional right to a presumption of innocence. And I know that's what you're proceeding on. The Court of Appeals and the certification indicates there's a threshold question here as to whether or not this practice, whether or not using number rather than name constitutes an anonymous jury. So that's a threshold issue. I would ask you to address that, but before you address that, I would ask you to delineate for me what you think are the issues in this case. You started from the get-go with you want a new trial, so relief, the type of relief is an issue. But what are the issues? If you'd work through those for me, assuming that the threshold issue is whether or not this even constitutes an anonymous jury.
Well, I think the issue is, when you have a defendant, there's no reason to believe that that particular defendant presents a real threat to juror safety. Should the court be entitled, as a matter of routine, as a matter of practice, to tell counsel for each party, when you refer to the jurors, when you address a juror in my courtroom, you do so by number only?
Okay, so now you've said, it seems to me what you've articulated is whether or not the court can have a blanket rule as opposed to an individual determination, which at least heretofore seems to be suggested by the case.
Correct.
That's an issue.
Right. I believe a blanket rule is inappropriate. If there are specific facts justifying a strong reason to believe that the person on trial may threaten, may attempt to tamper with the jury, then the practice is appropriate.
I just want the issues. Well, that's the issue. What's another issue in this case?
Well, another issue is, and I believe the federal courts of appeals have analyzed this correctly, does that impinge upon the presumption of innocence when the jurors are brought into a courtroom and they're in a situation where they're aware I'm being referred to by a number, and when my name happens to be mentioned, the court instructs counsel to stop, not do that. What does that mean?
Now, here, counsel, just looking at the blue brief, page 31, the judge talks about Britt, and she says in the bottom, page 31, 126, that certainly, it talks about Britt, that certainly was a case involving gangs and involving violence, which is different from this case. Now, this is the judge saying that. This
Correct.
Is a case involving drugs and an allegation of drug dealing, which I think raises the bar to some extent in terms of any danger to the jury, jurors. Now, this goes to this blanket question of Justice Bradley. Because this is a case involving sale of drugs, I'm going to use numbers for the jurors here. And generally, what I do is advise jurors that it is a practice of this court simply to use numbers, and I won't read the rest. So from that, are you indicating that you think that this was, for Judge Miller, this was for common practice?
That's my understanding.
The word generally, so I don't know if that's a blanket rule, but it seems in those areas she was delineating or taking something out of the Britt case where she was using numbers rather than names. So,
correct. Well, if I could also, Your Honor, page 30 of the same transcript, beginning at line 22, the court, all right, I'll grant the motion for sequestration. It has been my practice to use numbers and not names in this court. Mr. Cafferty, do you have any objection to that? I do, Your Honor. And as I read the transcript, then the court essentially recalled Britt and, conceded that there should be particularized findings, that practice should be employed, and she referred to that, yes, indeed, this is, the allegation is possession with intent to deliver. And I think that situation is somewhat analogous to one of the Federal Courts of Appeals cases where it says, look, we need specific, concrete information about the particular defendant. It's not enough to invoke magic words like mob or mafia. Get to the specific facts of this particular case.
Counsel, I don't want to impede your argument. I just want to know what the issues are. For instance, is there an issue in this case as, and I don't want to create issues, I just want to know what they are. Is there an issue in this case as to what the standard should be, and if so, if it should be modified in Wisconsin, is that an issue or is it not an issue?
Excuse me, I believe the law as it exists is entirely appropriate. A mechanism like this may be employed.
So is that an issue or is that not an issue?
I believe the law...
As you see and read your opposing counsel's brief, I just want to know what the issue is.
As I see it, the law should not be changed. Britt and Murillo and the Federal Courts of Appeals announced the appropriate standard.
I think, note on page maybe 4 of their brief that they... argue that that's the right page, something different. They argue, I think, for modification of the standard. I might have the wrong page in the wrong case, heaven knows. The court should modify the definition of what constitutes an anonymous jury. So I understand that maybe that might be an issue in this case. Is it or is it not?
I'm perfectly comfortable with the court providing a more refined, detailed definition of what an anonymous jury is.
Okay, let me ask it again. Are there any other issues in this case?
Well, there is the issue, did the trial court err by refusing to allow admission of a hearsay statement of the defendant, Damien McRae?
That's the second. With regard to the jurors, are there any other issues?
No, I believe the issue is, was this an anonymous jury? I believe it was. I believe another issue is, should the law as it exists be changed? I believe it should not.
I'd like to interject another issue that I think is present in the case, and that is, why should we accept the premise in the first instance that an anonymous jury, provided that the parties have the identifying information, that an anonymous jury violates the presumption of innocence in the first place?
It doesn't. To come to that conclusion does involve inference. What will potential jurors make of the fact that they can't be referred to by name in open court?
Isn't it purely speculative?
And
did any of those federal courts actually hit that issue head on, or did they just accept it and then decide what the procedure should be before paneling an anonymous jury?
To be blunt, as I read the Federal Courts of Appeals cases, it was taken as a given, almost an axiomatic statement.
So there is no case that has actually even examined that premise.
I'm unaware of any empirical study that has studied that issue.
Well,
however,
couldn't you call on each juror and ask them? I mean, if this was sent back, for example, and say, what was the effect on you?
As I understand the prohibitions of Statute 906.06 sub 2, post-conviction counsel would be precluded from doing so, would be prohibited from bringing in any particular juror or jurors to have them testify about what, if anything, they may have been referred to by a number.
So to avoid speculation, if you don't have empirical studies, you'd have to ask each juror in at the voir dire, what's the effect on you of being called by number?
That would be one way.
But the trial judge was reluctant to go very far into advising the jurors about why they're using numbers.
Correct. She said she preferred just to jump right into the practice and refer to them by numbers. And as I understood her in the transcript, she intended to give a general cautionary instruction, but it just never took place in this instance.
Did not. Does she generally do that, or don't you know?
I don't know.
Could I ask you to argue by analogy here on compromising the presumption of innocence? What other things that are visual in nature would tend to compromise the defendant's presumption of innocence?
For instance, a jailer escorting the defendant from the jail to the courtroom. Let's say that defendant assaults the jailer. Well, you know, now that defendant has obviously done something outrageous, and the court, given that fact, can say, look, we have to shackle this defendant in the courtroom. That will have an effect on the juror's perceptions of that defendant. In that particular instance, though, the defendant brought that on himself or herself by their actions on the way to the courtroom. And in addition, the court, presumably in that instance, would also give a cautionary instruction to the jury not to make anything of the fact that the defendant was shackled in terms of...
Well, what about a jail, an orange jumpsuit in court?
That will do so, and I believe trial counsel will have been ineffective if he fails to make a request to the court that his client be permitted to appear at trial in street clothes.
What if there's normally a bailiff in the court, but suddenly two deputies are in court?
Well, I don't believe the rule is that no actions can be taken during a trial that might diminish, touch upon the presumption of innocence. So there's certain things that, as a matter of course, must be done. The defendant will not be in court unless he or she is accused of a crime, unless an information has been filed. That's unavoidable. As I understand the Federal Courts of Appeals, they're saying, look, in our Western legal tradition, the presumption of innocence to be tried by a jury of your peers that you know by name has been with us for so long. Don't impinge upon that unless there's reason to do so.
So you would not be here, theoretically, if the trial judge had said, on the basis of information in the record, and complaints about this defendant intimidating people, I'm going to ask them to refer to the juror by number. Or
right.
Some other statement that made sense that gave plausible, reasonable, whatever, grounds to the judge to do this protective
technique. Correct. If there had been a record that this particular juror, there was evidence that she or associates had attempted to intimidate potential witnesses before a trial, that she had a track record of trying to tamper with juries.
But just how that would that be conveyed in this case, it seems to me that the jury shouldn't be told. Counsel can be told, but jury shouldn't be told that you have to worry about this particular defendant. So isn't it a more logical way to handle it that it was to both sides? The defense knew the name and the number, but the jury was just going to, so they might have not thought any different. I mean, is that a presumption there, too? Because if the jury is ever informed about that, you're just talking about who would be informed throughout this.
Well, the Federal Courts of Appeals suggest that if you do have a situation where the defendant presents a real threat to the jury, develop a cautionary instruction for the jury. Certainly don't inform the jury the reason we're proceeding this way is because the court's afraid that this defendant or his associates are going to harm you. Come up with a neutral explanation as to why it's being done. The Federal Courts of Appeals have expressed some reservation about the fact that, at least in one instance, it was, for lack of a better word, a white lie. They informed the jury that the reason it was being done was concern about the press being after them during the pendency of the trial, when in reality the underlying reason was the court was fearful of the defendant.
Well, in that sense, isn't a general practice of anonymous juries, provided that the parties have the information, but the general practice of anonymous juries a better approach, and an approach that is less burdensome on the presumption of innocence, to the extent there's a burden at all?
See, I don't think so. I think there's a danger that adopting this practice as a general rule may feed a non-rational fear that each and every single criminal defendant is a member of a class of others that is dangerous, that poses a threat to normal men and women sitting on a jury.
Isn't that entirely speculative? If you tell a jury, look, we're going to refer to you by number in the courtroom as a reasonable recognition of your privacy interests and of story, isn't that perfectly innocuous as far as the presumption of innocence is concerned?
There's no doubt in the particular instance of a general cautionary instruction, very bluntly said, look, I just do it this way in my court because that's the way I do it. You are to draw absolutely no inferences from that fact regarding this particular defendant's threat to you or guilt or innocence on the crime charge. Nonetheless, if that policy is adopted as a general rule, I do think it feeds a sense that criminal defendants are in a class of others. They're really, each and every one is really fundamentally different from the normal, decent men and women that sit on a jury.
Mr. Lazat, let's assume for a minute that this was error by Judge Miller. Why shouldn't we apply a harmless error analysis then? And if we do, what do you think the result?
One reason I don't think you should apply a harmless error analysis, I think it puts an unfair burden on the defendant because of the rules against impeaching a jury verdict. Post-conviction counsel and the defendant, you know, really have their respective hands tied. How are they going to get that evidence into court?
Appellate court speculate as to whether or not the error is harmless. You because we don't have statistics or empirical studies either way, so we guess.
Well, if they're going to guess, then I think they should guess in favor of the individual defendant and say, okay, this defendant is entitled to a new trial. This defendant did nothing to warrant having the presumption of innocence eroded in this fashion. Perhaps it is a slight diminishment. It's not as great a diminishment as other things, but there is a real concern by those who have thought about it that it is indeed a diminishment. And if the defendant has done nothing to bring it on herself or himself, I think it's fair to say the burden rests on the court. You're going to have to conduct another trial. The defendant did not bring this on himself or herself. Thank you. The red light's on.
Thank you, counsel. Assistant Attorney General Kathleen Tassick, is it? It's okay, we'll take care of that later.
It is fantastic. Marshall.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Kathleen Potasek appearing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. Your Honors have raised a number of questions, and perhaps the best place for me to start is to address the question of what is the issues here. And it's the State's position that the jury impaneled in the Tucker case was not an anonymous jury under the modification to Britt suggested by the Court of Appeals. It is the State's position that under Britt, as the Court of Appeals properly pointed out in its certification, if there's any restriction on voir dire, then under the law as pronounced in Britt, that is an anonymous jury. The State had argued in Britt that that was not an anonymous jury, but that position was rejected, in fact, by the Court of Appeals. And the Court now has requested that Britt be revisited. Therefore, it's the State's position that when no information is withheld from the parties and when there is absolutely no restriction placed on the questions that may be asked during voir dire, but only the only restriction is placed on how the jurors are addressed, then the Court of Appeals is correct that the restrictions in Tucker are even less than those that were implemented in Britt, and therefore it's the State's position that no anonymous jury even exists in this case.
But counsel, what about the questions that are being asked here? This is a blanket rule. That particular judge is saying in every case involving drugs, or generally, that I'm going to have numbers rather than names. Is that an appropriate practice for this court to put its stamp of approval on?
Your Honor, I believe that the Britt case does point out that it is an exercise of discretion for the court when it does choose to restrict voir dire in some way. And here the State concedes that voir dire was restricted in terms of the use of numbers. I like to refer to this jury in the Tucker case as a numbers jury rather than an anonymous jury, since there were absolutely no other restrictions placed on the voir dire, and nor was there any restriction placed on the information given to the defendant. So I think Your Honor brings up an interesting question, and that is this blanket, should this be blanket authority for a court to do this? I think that Not so much blanket, Your Honor, because, again, the Britt Court does tell us this is an exercise of discretion. The federal courts that address anonymous juries talk about the totality of the circumstances. And also, the federal courts and the ones the state cites in... I'm sorry, am I too loud? Should I back
sound
off?
Sound to you like it's too loud?
It does. Is that all right for you?
It's just been sound. So soft in here the last year. We're glad to hear everybody.
Oh, okay. Please let me know if I should back up.
Problem? I mean, are you getting...
No. I just... Thank you, Your Honor. Several of the federal cases the state cites in its brief regarding, again, going to the standard of review here is that we must be particularly deferential to the trial judge, familiar as he is with the local ambience. That's a citation from U.S. v. Crockett, and that's citing U.S. v. Scarfo. That is in the state's brief in this case. And that same Scarfo quotation is in U.S. v. Edmund. That's all in the state's brief. So coupling the three things, that this is an exercise of discretion, it's based on the totality of the circumstances, and I take that from a case that defendant cited in her reply brief at page 5, U.S. v. Ross, 33 F. 3rd at 1521, note 26. So we've got an exercise of discretion. It's a particularly deferential review under Crockett. And third, under Ross, totality of the circumstances. I think it does require some deliberation on the part of the trial judge. In other words, should numbers be employed all across the board? Only if in the discretion of the trial court it's appropriate in that case is the state's position, because of all these other standards that do impact that decision on review.
Is there anything on the record in this case that shows an exercise of discretion by Judge Miller?
I believe there is some, Your Honor. It, as the state pointed out in its brief, it could have been a fuller discussion. But what the judge did in this case was cite to State v. Britt, cited the fact that this was a drug case, and as the state points out in Roman numeral 2 of its brief, there were a number of other facts in the record that would have supported the use of even a Britt anonymous jury, which we are now contending, pursuant to the certification, that this was not anonymous. But the trial judge gave a very bare bones rationale. This is a drug case, and this is the practice of this court.
Counsel, are you finished answering?
Yes, Your Honor.
You've said that the state's position is that this is not an anonymous jury, and I tend to agree with that. But then that leads me to ask, what purpose is served by the judge doing this? I mean, the jurors know that the defendant knows their name. The jurors know that the whole courthouse can know their name. At least certainly the clerk's office knows their name. The jurors know that the press can get their names unless the judge has shut them down somehow and there's nothing to indicate that she did. So what purpose has served her other than alarming the jury?
We're back to some of that non-empirical evidence that was inquired about when my opponent was up here. There is some anecdotal evidence in the treatises that the jurors feel more comfortable, that jurors may feel more inclined to be divulging of sensitive information if their name is not used, rather that rather
even
a number.
They know that it's really a placebo. Because this strikes me as a placebo.
Judge Miller has used the numbers in this case, as has Judge Flynn in the two other reported precedential anonymous jury cases in the state, Murillo and Britt. But all three of these cases come out of Racine. And again, going back to the indication from U.S. v. Crockett that we must be particularly deferential to the trial judge, familiar as he, or I would add she, is with the local ambience, that all three of these cases, the two reported ones and this, are out of Racine, indicates to me that there may be more than a placebo effect here. Whatever that may be,
you can't identify.
It's not in the record, Your Honor, well, and that's why I cite the treatises.
What about just thinking about this? What is the advantage?
The treatises point to the fact that there's anecdotal evidence that some people do not choose to register to vote for fear that they'll be called as on a jury duty. There also is indication from, and I know it may be sound less than scholarly, but the Glamour magazine article that was cited that many younger women ages 18 to 40-something suggested that jurors should be anonymous in all cases. Juror comfort seems...
I understand that jurors want to be anonymous, but, I mean, unless these jurors are totally lacking in intelligence, and I don't think they are, they have to know that everybody knows. So they're being called a number.
Well, the purpose in this case, and I think it was a little more carefully explained on the record than I indicated earlier, I believe, and I've read so many of these in the last week, but I believe, and if I could just have 1 second to look at Judge Miller's ruling here. She says it raises the bar to some extent in terms of danger to the jurors. Ah, here it is. It's on, it's in the record 46:32-33. Judge Miller said this: what I'm prohibiting is the names of jurors being stated in the courtroom and for the record when other people may be sitting in the audience and using those names for any other reasons. So in this case, when she says it's a drug case, when we do have an entry made by SWAT team members, when guns have been found, drugs have been dealt, it appears that Judge Miller, without articulating it more fully, was indicating that she did not want other members sitting in the courtroom to be aware of the names
other
of the jurors.
You mean members, citizens?
Citizens. That's,
they have access to that information, don't they? All they got to do is go to the clerk's office.
Your Honor, I would have no reason to doubt that. It may be a matter of them having to take the extra effort. I'm not sure what the clerk's policy would be there.
Counsel, to follow up on Justice Babbage, one of my concerns is this. You indicated deferential standard of review as one of the reasons. And yet, just focusing on what you're talking about, there has to be reasons that are articulated. I look at the Britt case, and the Britt case indicates the court should not impanel an anonymous jury without first concluding there's a strong reason to believe the jury needs protection. We have nothing like that in this record. Is that correct?
All respect, Your Honor, I disagree.
Okay, that's fine. I just...
Yes. The first issue is that it should be modified to find this is not an anonymous jury, but even if the law is not modified, I believe there's plenty in the record to indicate that this... there is a strong reason to believe that this juror, these jurors should have numbers rather than names.
What, you're answering in a way that brings up a point that I want to explore. It's, by a prior answer, it seemed to me you suggested that the judge may not have articulated the reasons. And so if the judge did not articulate the reasons, then we cannot give deferential nod to the finding. But you're saying this court then should explore the record de novo, and in the record we will, on our own, come up with the reasons.
That is the state's alternative position, yes, Your Honor. And if you would like me to recite some of the facts that support that, I'd be happy to, but that may not be where your inquiry is leading.
Thank you. I want to start with the threshold. My threshold, then, is it seems to me what you referred to in response to Justice Babbage, that is pages 32 and 33 of the transcript. I'm not sure if I find that sufficient as the court articulating reasons. You've got the court saying it's my blank rule.
My practice, although she does not indicate in every case or in every drug case, she doesn't go that far in this record.
At page 30 she says it's been my practice to use numbers and not names in this court. And I think 32, she says, because it's a case involving the sales of drugs, I'm going to use numbers for the jurors here. And generally what I do is to advise the jurors that it's my practice at this court simply to use numbers, etc. Hope I'm not skipping anything he's saying, etc. My reading of this is that this is a blanket rule of the court, and that there has been no individualized determination as to this case, whether or not it's necessary. Do you disagree with that?
I disagree, Your Honor. I believe by saying this is a drug case and citing State v. Britt and pointing out her concern about people, the members of the public in the audience, she, in a shorthand fashion, indicated that she believed that this met the standard set forth in Britt.
So anytime a judge says, this is a drug sale case, drug dealing, and there's a possibility that there may be people in the audience, or anytime somebody from the audience comes in, you to refer to them by number is adequate.
Your Honor, in the court's discretion, because I don't have the records in those hypothetical cases in front of me, I believe what Your Honor is asking me to do is talk about the state's first position. Is that an anonymous jury? Is that a blanket rule?
I'm going to go back to the anonymous jury. From my perspective, at least when I'm sitting here, I don't care how you label it. I would label a jury. And I think the issue is, in a case in which it appears, or it can be interpreted to appear, I'll put it differently, in any case, may a judge have the jury referred to by number without making a without exercising discretion that this is required in this particular case for reasons that are set forth in this particular case. I don't care if you label it anonymous or not. The only reason you are fighting about anonymous, it seems to me, is whether or not various anonymous cases apply. But I think you have to look at the facts
right.
of this case. You're only dealing with column by number, and then you say, one, is it ever okay to call them by number? Two, is it okay to call them by number where you have particular facts in this particular case? Three, even if you called them by number, is that harmless error? And then other
right.
issues that everybody has raised.
Right.
I may not have stated the way everyone else stated, but that's how I see the case.
Right. You know, Your Honor, the law does indicate that this is an exercise of discretion, that there really is no blanket rule, and therefore something needs to be stated.
If that's true, then your answer is, it is not okay to call, in every case, to call the juror by number. That, if that's true, that it's an exercise of discretion, that you have, the judge has to exercise discretion in that particular case. It's case-by-case analysis.
Right. Let's say a local administrative judicial district adopted a local rule that specified the use of anonymous juries or reference to jurors by number in open court when jurors are being referenced. You would say that that's unconstitutional?
No, Your Honor, thank you for clarifying that. No, I'm not suggesting that's not constitutional at all. The constitutional issue is joined when the presumption of innocence issue is raised. It is not the state's position that the presumption of innocence is eroded in any way by use of numbers.
Then why are we here?
It's our position this is not an anonymous jury. The parties had all information.
So it's your position, the state's position is, in any case, the judge may, in any case and in every case, the judge may require use only of numbers, not names.
Your Honor, and I'm sorry if I sound like I'm vacillating, I think that is correct because in that court's exercise of discretion, in that locale, based on the specifics, that may be quite appropriate.
How is there an exercise of discretion if you've got a rule in an administrative district, like Justice Sykes just asked you, where we always use numbers? At least we always use numbers in felony cases. Now, what exercise of discretion is going on by the judge?
The rule brings up a new issue that I had not considered, Your Honor. If that's the judicial rule in the district, then certainly the court can abides by that rule and applies that rule. That would be similar to the People v. Williams case from Michigan where they say unless information is withheld from the parties or affirmative prejudice can be shown, there's no claim here regarding the juror issue. And a judicial rule, I think, would be consistent with the rule adopted in People v. Williams in the Michigan case I cited.
I heard you talking previously about the judge looking at the totality of the circumstances, the judge now backing away from that?
I may have been confused, Your Honor, with all of the cases that do refer to the anonymous juries. I am backing away from that, Your Honor. I am backing away from that for this reason. I was confused for a while there about whether the proper showing was made of harm. I'm going to take the position now that this is not an anonymous jury, and for this is a numbers jury, and perhaps then the totality of the circumstances does not apply here.
Your position is all numbers juries are okay.
Right, right. And I apologize for my confusion. I apologize. I did not think of the judicial district rule. I apologize.
That would be your position is that all numbers juries are okay as long as all other information that is available to counsel. That, to the defendant.
That's correct. And that's the People v. Williams of approach in Michigan. That's correct. Unless you can show affirmative prejudice. And I have an example, if you would like, of affirmative prejudice, and that would be in the case of State v. Aguilino, the evil eye case that the state cited in its brief. And that in that case, the defense counsel claimed that he could not get information on certain of the jurors because without their names, he could not tell if he had had prior contacts with certain of the jurors. And I think in those cases where information is not provided to defense counsel, then the restrictions placed on voir dire could be prejudicial to the defense.
Well, the issue that the defendant raises, at least as I hear it, is, and we keep saying okay, but I think what you mean are you getting a fair trial and a due process, right? Constitution. The issue the defendant raises is we watch Law and Order on TV, the jurors do. I don't watch enough TV to cite the other 500 situation TV dramas that deal with the court. We see court TV, and I don't remember them well enough to know if they refer to jurors by name. They read books. Again, I don't know if they refer to jurors by name. They serve on other juries where they are referred to by name. And so the defendant's position is that when they're referred to by number, it raises a suspicion in the jury's mind. And so why am I referred to by name, by number? Well, if it were I that was the judge, I'd refer to them by number because I mispronounce every name. Smith becomes Smythe to me. But that's not what they're going to think. They're going to think they're not telling my name because there's a reason they're not telling my name, and they don't want somebody to know my name, and I'm in danger. I mean, that's what the defense says. Your argument is, or should be, or might be, it's speculation. We have no proof of that.
That's correct.
And then you'd argue that the burden is on the defendant to prove that. The defendant argues that it's the burden of the state to show why you're deviating from the general rule of open trial, open records, open information about the jury. And you answer, we're deviating from that because, at least part of your answer is, we're deviating from that because the judge or the administrative rule, the makers of the administrative rule, think that there's danger, and that there's drug use and drug dealing and money and guns, and that they impute danger. They don't know either. They're speculating. So we got speculation on both sides. So then you have to resort, I think, to saying, hey, all numbers are okay. Right?
Counsel, that is your position. I mean, all numbers could be, you could use it in a civil trial, in a criminal trial. It just...
This has been employed in criminal trials, as far as I know, Your Honor. I'm not aware of the civil trials, but I think the court could use numbers in a civil trial as well. There might be a number of reasons for that. Again, to have the jurors be more divulging during voir dire so that the peremptory strikes can be that much more accurate. To make the jurors feel more comfortable so that they're more willing to serve jury duty. There could be any number of reasons the court could do that. And again, the court is offered, is given great deference in making that rule in its courtroom, or as the court points out, I suppose a judicial district could also employ that rule. I do not see a constitutional problem with that. There's even evidence in this record, and I cite this in response to some of the questions posed to my opponent, that there was no erosion of the presumption of innocence in this case. And I would cite the court to record page 4653, where this is after voir dire has been going on since page 33, so 20 pages of voir dire, many of which the court was employing the use of numbers. The court says this on page 53 of the first day of trial during voir dire. Does any member of this jury panel have any knowledge of this case other than what has been indicated to you in open court today? No responses. Then the court goes on. And this is the key part. Has any one of you, even with this small amount that you know at this point, formed an opinion as to what the outcome of this case should be? No response. And this is after roughly 20 pages of using numbers. There's no response that must be a dangerous person because you've been referring to me with number.
That brings up to me the argument you make that the defendant has to show prejudice, and you talk about the Williams case indicating that the defendant may be unable to show that not having the information in some way hampered preparation to the idea. But what about the prejudice of this chilling effect on the presumption of innocence? How is a defendant affirmatively going to show that? You point to the court saying, anyone formed an opinion that might cause you, and no one answered. Well, that's the favorite word. That's standard stuff. Isn't that an impossible burden? How often is the defendant going to be able to say, look, I have a juror here that's going to testify that because I was used a number and referred to by a number, that influenced and affected the presumption of innocence? You're not going to get that. Isn't that an impossible burden?
I have not seen a case, Your Honor, and I frankly think that that's why the use of numbers, not names, would appear to those jurors not to erode that presumption of innocence, would not be a basis for affirmative prejudice, because it's just so minor. It's like, I would argue, it's part of the court system. I'm going to cite Again, the case that my opponent cited in page 5 of his or her reply brief, U.S. v. Ross, this is what the court says there. Quote, the presumption of innocence does not, however, eliminate from the courtroom every reminder that the state has charged the defendant with criminal conduct, citing a case, Holbrook v. Flynn, a U.S. case. And in the parenthetical there, they say that case held that presence of armed, uniformed state troopers in the courtroom is not infringement on presumption of innocence. In other words, the fact that the defendant is in the courtroom, the fact that there's a judge with a black robe, the fact that there are bailiffs with a star, and the fact that there are jurors with numbers is all part of, the background wallpaper. It's part of the system. The jurors are part of the system, and that whole system is there to determine the guilt or innocence of that person who is presumed innocent and who is instructed by the judge that they are presumed innocent. So if this can be seen as part of the system in the background.
Well, that I think raises Justice Prosser's question, which he said, you know, you got this background. Guy can be shackled, he can have an orange jumpsuit, you got, usually have a bailiff, now you got two deputies, armed deputies in there. All of that is part of the system, and there's a reason for each of them. And when there's a reason, you say, look, it's part of the system. And that you give the instruction. The question is, seems to me, what do you keep adding? And if you're going to keep adding things that may impinge on the presumption of innocence, shouldn't you have a reason? Now, if the state answers, you don't need a reason here. You can have a blanket rule. And the question I have is, shouldn't you have a reason, just like Shackle, just like the orange suit, just like everything else? You have a reason.
Your Honor, I would argue that the shackles may be because the defendant is acting in a belligerent way that may be self-created.
Well, it's okay to shackle him. You have a reason to do that. And even when he's shackled, you usually put a skirt on the table so it doesn't show. So you can reduce that. It's okay to shackle him, but you have to have a reason in that case, right? Not every drug sale case. Is that right?
Are there shackles in every drug sale? I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
I'm saying that's my rule of court. I'm shackling everybody in every drug sale case.
Okay.
Is that going to work?
I don't believe that would be the rule in most courts.
No, but it is mine.
And if you've got the skirt, so that this is a person whose presumption of innocence is the Bridge Court talks about safeguards and says that if you're going to use numbers, and in Brit they said it also, if you're not going to be permitted to inquire about employers and or addresses, you're going to put some safeguards in. You're going to tell the jurors, and this may be Brit, but this may be some of the other cases where there were more severe restrictions put on voir dire than there were in Tucker. You're going to tell the jury this is your common practice, or this is being done for the media, or this is being done so that you don't get contacted by any of the lawyers, the government or the defense counsel, and this is just common, and this is how we do things here, and it's so that there's no indication that the defendant is a dangerous person. Shackles is a little bit different there. In fact, it's quite different because here this is a neutral reason. We're using numbers. It's what I do. Shackles tells me something about a defendant. And what Britt tells us, too, Your Honor, is this, that you can use some restrictions on voir dire, such as restricting names, addresses, and employers, even if, oh, I'm sorry, the red light's on, may I finish?
You may finish the sentence quickly.
Thank you. Even if it's not created by the defendant, but if the intimidation was caused by a witness or a victim, so therefore the defendant really doesn't have control over that. It could be anybody involved in the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Lizotte, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I have a question right away before you begin. Have you ever been in the Milwaukee County Courthouse?
Yes, I have.
And recently?
Yes.
Okay. And you're aware then that at the Milwaukee County Courthouse, to get in, one has to pass through a metal detector.
Yes.
You're also aware that every felony courtroom in Milwaukee County is equipped with security glass that divides the courtroom itself from the gallery, the spectator gallery in each courtroom.
I've seen courtrooms like that.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, based on my own personal experience, that every felony courtroom in the Milwaukee County Courthouse has such security glass. Do those burden, those safety and security precautions burden the presumption of innocence? Don't they communicate to the jurors as well as to everybody else in the courthouse that, you know, there's some dangerous people here and we're taking these precautions as a general matter for the protection of everybody? And, you know, what would your response be to the use of those kinds of devices and whether or not they infringe upon the presumption of innocence?
My response would be that those devices were probably put in place because of particular types of defendants. The defendant's position is not that there's no such thing as any criminal defendant that presents a risk to jurors or those in a courtroom. Things like a bulletproof glass, you know, that's quite an investment of time and money to put up. So.
Right, but we don't raise that and lower that on a case-by-case basis depending upon whether there's a particularized reason that relates to the defendant or the charge or prior conduct in order to have those precautions.
Well, yeah.
They're just there in the whole perimeter of the courthouse now has these checkpoints.
Well, yeah, the defendant is not advocating that bulletproof glass in courtrooms must be retractable so that defendants...
I thought your answer to Justice Sykes' good question would be that there's nothing wrong with those protections if they're there for everybody. But if they're up there only for a particular defendant, as in your case... You've got a particular defendant being singled out, essentially. Then you've got a problem. I would have a problem with that.
I think they do impinge upon the presumption of innocence, but there's a cost-benefit analysis. It's much more difficult to think of a way to put in place and not have in place bulletproof glass than to make a decision whether I will refer to these jurors by number or by name.
What if in Racine County, or what if any place, the rule was either we do it all the time or we don't do it at all? We refer to the jurors by number all the time or we don't do it at all. Would you be here today?
This would be a much more difficult case for my client if there had been a cautionary instruction that I do this as a matter of routine in every case.
Isn't that a reasonable inference from the record in this case? Because Judge Miller said this was her general practice.
That might be one reasonable inference. Another reasonable inference might be, my goodness, defense counsel just referred to me by last name. The judge interrupted him and instructed him to follow the practice. There must be something going on here in terms of this defendant and her associates. This judge doesn't want this defendant to know my name. What's going on?
Now, this conversation that's in the transcript, I assumed, maybe I'm wrong, that was out of the juror's presence. This conversation about it is my practice to do it, this case involves...
Correct, the original one where the judge announced the counsel.
So the only thing the jury heard was the judge correcting counsel.
Correct.
It's the only thing. The jury didn't know was her general practice. The jury didn't know was a drug case. That's what she
correct.
Practiced.
The jury
didn't know anything other than we referred by name and that counsel was corrected.
The jury heard two instances. The jury heard the judge start to call another potential juror, Mike, catch herself, refer to him by number, and then they heard the trial court interrupt defense counsel and instruct him to follow the practice. That was all they heard.
So if the judge had opened up voir dire by instructing the jury that you're going to be referred to by numbers, this is the general practice employed in this courtroom, it's for your privacy, don't draw any inferences against the defendant. That okay?
That would certainly be better for my client, but I'm not altogether certain that I wouldn't be here. Because I think it's a principle in our society that trial by jury means trial by known named peers.
Nobody's saying that these were not known named peers as far as the parties were concerned.
Correct. You know, the defendant's not complaining that I couldn't pick a fair jury. The defendant's concerned that a juror or more than one juror may have been speculating about why can I only be referred to as a number in open court. That's her concern. See, the red light is on. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you both, Mr. Lizotte and Ms. Potasik, for your argument in this case. That ends the hearing on 00-3354 CR State v. Tucker.